Here we go with the reading of today's Boston Herald for this Wednesday, the 18th of February, 2026. And with today's Wednesday, Boston Herald, we say hello to Ed and Fred.
Thank you, John, and good morning, all. Rhode Island tragedy, utter senselessness. Shooter kills ex-wife, son. Divorce records shed light on father's past. By Colleen Cronin. Police identified the two victims killed at an ice rink in Pawtucket Monday as the ex-wife and adult son of the shooter, as divorce records shed light on the father's past. Rhonda Dorgan was pronounced dead at the scene, and her son Aiden succumbed to his injuries at a local hospital. Pawtucket Police Chief Tina Gonzalez said at a press conference Tuesday. The shooter, Robert Dorgan, who went by Roberta, also critically injured Rhonda's parents, Linda and Gerald, and a family friend, Thomas Caruso. Gonzalez said all three were still in the hospital. It was very targeted, she noted. The victims had all gone to watch another son of Dorgan play hockey at Dennis M. Lynch Arena for his senior night. Dorgan was subdued by Good Samaritans before pulling out a second gun he'd taken into the venue and killing himself. Dorgan had legally purchased the two guns he brought into the rink, a 10mm Glock and a SIG 226, Gonsalves said. The department is working with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms to determine whether he had valid licenses to carry in other states. There were no expectations and indication that there was going to be violence, the chief said. Dorgan had attended other hockey games without issue, and there's no evidence so far that an altercation had occurred at the rink before the killings. There are still many unknowns, Gonzalez told the media, saying investigators are just trying to factually put the pieces together. They don't currently have a motive for the killing. Dorgan wasn't known to Pawtucket police. He was not a current Rhode Island resident, and he didn't leave behind a suicide note, she said. Pawtucket police have several search warrants out, and they plan on combing through Dorgan's social media posts, which will take hours because there are thousands, Gonzalez said. She couldn't say whether he had a history of mental health issues because they do not have his medical records yet. Everyone is looking for answers, she said. According to court records obtained by the Herald, Dorgan was married for 27 years before Rhonda filed for divorce in February 2020. Under the section of the filing that asks for the grounds of divorce, she listed gender reassignment surgery and narcissistic and personality disorder traits, which were then crossed out and replaced with irreconcilable differences. Rhonda requested for custody of the children and $150 weekly in child support. The couple was officially divorced by the next year. As law enforcement vehicles sat outside the arena Tuesday, a few people came by with flowers to pay their respects. North Providence juniors Ethan Casht and William Soares said they knew the victims and couldn't believe what had happened during the game the day before. They're a good family, Casht said, describing the victims as humble and kind. Nobody deserved it. Dorgan's daughter and Rhonda's stepdaughter, Amanda Wallace Hubbard, started a GoFundMe for the two siblings who have lost both their parents and older brother. The weight of this loss is something no one should ever have to bear, especially at such young ages, she wrote. It's February vacation week, but Soares said counselors would be coming to the school Thursday to provide support for students. It's not a fun feeling, he said, of his emotions in the aftermath of the news. State Senator Megan Callum, who represents Pawtucket, said she was devastated by the utter senselessness of the shooting, saying that the students and families were supposed to be celebrating and had plans for a potluck dinner after senior night. The people who live in Rhode Island have been through an awful lot over the last few months, Kalaman said. Her district is also right next to Brown University, where two students were killed at the end of December. Kalman said that there's a lot of work to be done both on access to guns and access to mental health care, and that she's worried about the way shootings have become normalized, especially for the young people who witness them. It's not normal, Kalman said. That's one more thing that they're going to have to live with for the rest of their lives.
On the U.S. Senate race, the article by Howie Carr, Markey and Moulton, dumb and dumber. The Massachusetts Democratic Senate primary race comes down to one issue, and one issue only. Who hates President Trump more? The statewide debates are months away, but you already know how they're going to play out. Senator Ed Markey, I really hate Donald Trump. Senator Seth Moulton, not as much as I hate him. Senator Ed Markey, I pledge that if I am reelected, I will hate Trump more than anybody anywhere. Senator Seth Moulton, I'm younger than you, and you old fart, so I won't ever get too tired to hate 24/7 on Donald Trump. In fact, my pledge to the voters is no one will ever out-hate Trump. This is a stupid thing. Trump more than me. And so on. All through the entire debate, all the debates, in fact, and then right up to the moment of the polls close at 8 p.m. on the evening of September 1st. In fact, this is the way all Democrat primaries everywhere will be playing out this year. But Markey and Moulton seem even more strident than your average TDS-afflicted Democrat poll. My theory is that their incoherent stridency is caused by the fact that they both are both white male heterosexuals and thus an endangered species in the modern Democratic Party. Even worse, they're both natives of Massachusetts. That, in and of itself, almost disqualifies you from running for office in the modern Massachusetts Democratic Party. Basically, Markey and Moulton are political dinosaurs. There's no place for them anymore in the Democratic politics. And so, like light-skinned blacks back in the Democratic Jim Crow days of the Old South, they're trying to pass. And they're always looking for new ways to show that, despite their racial, gender, or handicaps, they're woker than woke. Markey wants to impeach Trump. Moulton demands invocation of the 25th Amendment. ICE is either the Gestapo, Moulton, or the thugs, Markey. To unseat the incumbent, even one as feeble as Markey, you need to knock him out. Even a lightweight like Markey, who's nobody takes seriously, not even Markey. So Moulton really turns up the rhetoric, facts. He don't need no bleeping facts. On MSDNC recently, Moulton said of Trump, if you're one of the people like him who took advantage of young girls with Jeffrey Epstein, mother of God, even Morning Joe Scarborough had to interrupt him at that point. We don't have evidence that he took advantage of young girls with Jeffrey Epstein. Yes, but such statements poll well with the focus groups, especially in Massachusetts. And we're not talking about the political party anymore. Democrats have become a cult. Markey turns 80 in July 11th. He sometimes gives off a retro vibe, like he thinks he's still 1974 and his voters haven't collectively gone insane. Thus, the Olympics began. He sent out pro forma good wishes to all the Olympians from New England. He observed the anniversary of the Armenian genocide, and most oddly, he attacks Trump as a tax man. Markey understand that if you must work to pay taxes, the vast majority of Democrats who will be going voting in September, September 1st, don't work. Ergo, they don't pay taxes. The only tax Democrats now care about is the wealth tax, which they want to impose on everybody evil enough to actually work for a living. Worrying about taxes on his non-working voters makes Markey seem out of it. Moulton plays on the age issue, but not so obliquely. He endlessly refers to Trump as the senile president who is increasingly senile. Interestingly, when Moulton isn't calling Trump senile, he's denouncing him as a petulant child. He says he can't psychoanalyze him because I'm not a child psychologist. So, which is Trump senile or a child? Which is Trump senile or a child? It doesn't make much sense. But when you appeal to a cult like modern Democrats, you have to have a rationale. Consider the case of Kings. Remember, no Kings? Both the Eminem boys were all in on denouncing hereditary monarchs until the moment Donald Trump demanded Denmark turn over Greenland to the U.S. Denmark has a king, hereditary king. Guess whose side the no king twins are on now? Markey fumed. Enough is enough. And incited the poll showing that 75% of Americans are opposed to takeover of Greenland. Oddly, however, Markey has no opinion whatsoever on the actual election of 2024, in which 72% of Massachusetts residents demanded an audit of the state legislators' books. And the Kings in the legislature and the judiciary have refused to permit it. How about unions? Markey is so angry about Trump trying to shut down Vineyard Wind, saying it's a union job killer and it's going to hike electric bills. Oh, Senator, what about when Joe Biden shut down the Keystone Pipeline in 2021? That killed 11,000 union jobs and raised energy costs. And what we got is some response from you, and now get from your office on a Stonewall legislature audit. 2.3 million mass voters endorsed in 2024. Crickets. As doddering as Markey appears, he has one, you'll pardon the expression, Trump card against the narcissistic Ivy League Moulton. Let Moulton take an illegal alien to the state of the Union. Markey will always have the trans card. You may recall Moulton's near career-ending gaffe in which he defined in politics what is an inadvertent telling of the truth. Moulton has two young daughters, and in interviews he offhandedly mentioned that he wouldn't want his girls injured in athletic competition with guys or transgender women. And that was all it took. There are rallies against him. He had primary opponents. 2 years before his election, his groveling apology appears to never end. And so now on Markey's campaign store website, you can buy T-shirts and bumper stickers that say, "Protect trans kids. Get the hint? Moulton store, no rainbows." Like his tweets, Markey's store is a stroll down memory lane. He promotes Green New Deal and has a sweatshirt that says, "Protect others. Wear a mask." Like Joe Biden, In 50 years in politics, Markey has never been right once about anything. Always wrong, but never in doubt. But now he's up against a guy who was just wrong except once. And that once was the time was right almost ended his career. And now they go head-to-head for 6 more months debating the only issue of the times. I hate Trump. No, I hate Trump more than you. No, you don't. No one will ever hate Trump more than me. Oh, yeah? Here's how much I hate Trump. To be continued and continued and continued.
More snow on the horizon. Meteorologists are also watching a potentially significant winter storm. By Rick Sobey. Here we snow again. More snow is on the way to the base date for Wednesday, according to the National Weather Service, which has issued a winter weather advisory for the afternoon and evening commute. Boston could get up to 3 inches of snow, while localized amounts of 5 inches of snow are possible in central and western Massachusetts. There's also the potential for a trace of ice accretion. Untreated roads are expected to be slippery. Travel will likely be impacted Wednesday afternoon and Wednesday night due to low visibility at times and snow-covered roads. NWS Boston wrote in its advisory for Central and Western Mass. Plan on extra travel time, NWS Boston added. Slow down and use caution while traveling. It's a challenging forecast when it comes to the precipitation type and where a narrow band of snow sets up, National Weather Service noted. For the Boston and Providence areas, temperatures initially may be too warm to allow snow to accumulate, so NWS is forecasting 1 to 3 inches of snow for there. It's possible NWS will need to extend the winter weather advisories into these areas if things trend a bit colder. The snow should end shortly after midnight, well ahead of the Thursday morning commute. Then later this week, a system on Friday into Friday night is expected to bring a mix of snow, freezing rain, and rain to the region. Models were showing a 15% to 40% chance of 4-plus inches of snow throughout Saturday along and south of the Mass Pike, with a 40% to 55% chance to the north. Meanwhile, meteorologists are watching a potential winter storm Sunday into Monday. Guidance continues to show a potentially significant winter storm developing off the East Coast Sunday into Monday. But as usual, at this time range, we're seeing a large spread in possible storm tracks, with anything from an offshore pass to a direct hit on southern New England, NWS Boston wrote, adding, it's just way too soon to lock into any one model solution. This storm would bring the potential for coastal flooding and marine impacts, even with a more offshore track. There will be higher astronomical tides Sunday and Monday, so much of the coast could be vulnerable to at least minor coastal flooding and beach erosion.
Hit and run. Cops strip club outing ends in deadly crash. Police. Hanover officer accused in killing a pedestrian. A Massachusetts police officer is on administrative leave as he is accused of an off-duty fatal hit-and-run on his way home from a night of drinking with friends at a Brockton strip club. The Hanover Police Department has placed Thomas Hayes, 36, on leave as the officer faces charges of motor vehicle homicide and leaving the scene of an accident following a personal injury or death. Hayes is being held on $15,000 cash bail and ordered not to operate any motor vehicle as a condition of release following an arraignment in Brockton District Court on Tuesday. First and foremost, we extend our deepest condolences to the family and loved ones of the deceased, Hanover Police Chief Timothy Kane said in a statement, any loss of life is a profound tragedy, and our thoughts are with all those affected. We hold our officers to the highest standards of conduct, both on and off duty, the chief added. Officers with the Brockton Police Department responded to the reports of an unresponsive man lying in a snowbank near the intersection of Battles and Cross Street around 12:30 a.m. Monday. After arriving at the scene, officers found the victim, later identified as Alfredo Alves, 23. Responders rushed Alves to the Boston Medical Center, south in Brockton, where he was pronounced dead shortly after. Al suffered what Brockton police described as a basal skull fracture. The fracturing of the skull was so severe that the blood flow from life-saving measures caused the eyes to pulse, the departure report states. The witness later voluntarily reported to the Brockton police that they were a passenger in the vehicle that struck Alves in a 2022 Ford Explorer, according to the prosecutors. The witness identifying Hayes as the driver and also state that the SUV sustained a shattered windshield during the crash. Law enforcement found the Ford Explorer with damage consistent with what was described following the crash in Hayes' driveway in his Hanover residence. The Plymouth County District Attorney's Office stated in a release. The Brockton Police report noted how Hayes' friends allegedly told officers they continued to drink at the strip club at the Boardroom Cafe after leaving the Daytona 500 party earlier in the evening at a friend's house in Avon. One passenger allegedly told police that they wanted Hayes to stop and check what he had hit while driving home from the strip club, but the off-duty officer said he'd respond later Monday morning. Hanover police and town officials said in a statement, as a result of his arrest, Officer Hayes was placed on administrative leave immediately by Police Chief Timothy Kane.
From the Celtics, I can no longer stay silent. Bill Russell's widow sues daughter over late legend's tarnished image, by Lance Reynolds. Bill Russell's widow has sued the late Celtics legend's daughter, arguing she has tarnished her father's image with statements about his health. Janine Russell says she's on a mission to preserve her husband's legacy, alleging Karen Russell of breaching a legal contract by making a claim that her father had well-known cognitive issues. The complaint, filed in a Seattle Superior Court in Washington late last month, is the latest legal dispute between Russell's widow and children. Through her legal team, Janine Russell announced the complaint and highlighted some of its details in a press release Tuesday. A sticking point in the argument is a claim that Karen Russell made to the Boston Globe in an interview last October. The daughter was quoted saying, "My dad had well-known cognitive issues." The claim, Janine Russell argues, breached a so-called confidentiality and non-disparagement agreement and mutual releases document, CNA, stemming from prior litigation. In 2015, Karen Russell and her brother filed a complaint against their father and stepmother. They argued Bill was a vulnerable adult and accused Janine of exploiting Bill. Janine Russell's legal team says that the claims were resolved through written agreements, including the CNA. After execution of the CNA, Karen materially breached the agreements, and specifically the CNA, the legal team said in a statement, pointing directly to the daughter's claim to the Globe. Though Karen made this claim, it was not true and was not substantiated in any proceeding, the team said. Indeed, Bill was cleared by a medical professional to make his own decisions in connection with the action. Karen voluntarily accepted over $500,000 in consideration to retract this claim and agree not to make it public. Bill Russell, on the Mount Rushmore of Boston sports with a whopping 11 titles as a player, including 2 championships as the first black head coach in U.S. pro sports, died at the age of 88 on July 31, 2022. Russell, the greatest champion in basketball history, with a trademark laugh, was also a civil rights activist who marched with Martin Luther King Jr. and who had an uncompromising, dignified, and always constructive commitment to principle, his family wrote in a message announcing his death. Russell would talk about playing for the Celtics institution, but not playing for Boston and the fans, who blasted him with racist taunts. His Reading home was broken into and vandalized. Of the lawsuit filed against his daughter, Janine Russell said, "I can no longer stay silent while my husband's incredible and unique legacy is tarnished. I have decided to speak out," the widow added in a statement, "and take action to preserve Bill's memory in the way he intended." Efforts to reach Karen Russell on Tuesday were not successful. Karen, while not commenting on the lawsuit, did take to social media on Tuesday in remembrance of civil rights champion Jesse Jackson. Karen posted a photo of her with Jackson and her father. "I do not know a world without Reverend Jesse Jackson," Karen posted. "Jackson was a fixture in the Russell household and a force for justice in the world. Jackson taught millions to believe in their worth and challenged America to live up to its ideals. We mourn him. We honor him. We will continue the work and keep hope alive.
Seeking more sunlight, DeSoglio announces re-election bid amid audit legal fight. Democratic State Auditor Diane DeSoglio has officially launched her 2026 re-election campaign as she continues her legal battle against legislative leaders in an effort to enforce an audit of the legislature approved by 72% of the voters in 2024. When I ran for state auditor, I made a simple promise to audit state government without fear or favor and to always put the public interest first. Since taking my office, my team and I have done exactly that, launching audits, demanding accountability, and standing up for taxpayers, even when it hasn't been easy. DeSoglio said on a Tuesday morning email to supporters announcing her re-election bid, "You've seen what we can do with a little sunlight. Our audits have identified challenges and made recommendations for improvements as agencies and entities like the Department of Children and Families, the Massachusetts Bay Transit Authority, the Executive Officer of Elder Affairs, the Holyoke and Chelsea Soldiers Homes, and more, all in an effort to bring government work better for everyday people," she said. DeSoglio, who announced her bid for re-election on Tuesday morning, posted to X, was first elected in 2022, replacing the departing former state auditor Suzanne Bump. DeSoglio, after she was elected, dove right into her push to conduct an audit of the state legislature through lawsuits and ballot initiatives. She seeks a second four-year term in the midst of her latest legal action against legislative leaders, specifically House Speaker Ron Mariano and Senate President Karen Spilker, announcing last week that she's going to the Massachusetts Supreme Court to compel the legislature to comply with the audit. The voters gave the auditor a clear mandate to audit the legislature, and I take that responsibility seriously. I have filed a lawsuit in the Supreme Judicial Court to enforce that law because oversight shouldn't stop where the power begins. Democracy only works when the people are at the table, DeSoglio told her reporters. The lawsuit also seeks permission to appoint outside counsel selected by the auditor's office, the Special Assistant Attorney General, to represent them, something Attorney General Andrea Campbell says DeSoglio does not have the authority to do. Republican U.S. Senate candidate John Deaton, along with a group of Massachusetts residents, has filed a similar lawsuit under the century-old state law to prevent an unlawful expenditure of public funds by the Massachusetts legislature. DeSoglio has also seen public support from retired Massachusetts trial court judge Carol Erskine, now working as a media consultant and a contributor. Erskine posted a fiery message to social media in defense of DeSoglio, slamming former colleagues at the trial and appeals court for their recently taking a position that state courts are not subject to audits, just as the state legislature has done since the audit was approved by 72% of the voters in the 2024 election. DeSoglio's legal efforts have also gained national media attention, with the state auditor appearing on Fox News Saturday in America program to discuss her recent lawsuit. According to the WBUR Mass GOP executive director, Haley Jones says that while the party does not have a declared candidate for a state auditor, it is actively recruiting. "I'm ready to keep up this fight as I launch my campaign for re-election, but I can't do this alone. I need your help," says DeSoglio. "If you believe in good government and real oversight and the auditor who answers the people, not powerful insiders, please consider making a contribution today."
An obituary. There was a bridge called Jesse Jackson across decades of civil rights advocacy by Aaron Morrison and Sophia Tarrant. Chicago. From the moment the Reverend Jesse Jackson stepped forward as a torchbearer to what was then a largely Southern civil rights struggle, a movement with much unfinished business, he created a bridge. From the South's fight with Jim Crow to the North's battle with systemic racial inequality, from the buttoned-up conservative generation of King's Circle to the dashiki-wearing black power leaders and the activists of the hip-hop generation, Jackson forged a link between improbable dreams and political power. From Martin Luther King to Barack Obama, there's a bridge called Jesse Jackson, the Reverend Al Sharpton said. Jackson, a protege of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., who led the civil rights movement for decades after the revered leader's assassination, died on Tuesday, his family said. He was 84. Jackson kept up his public advocacy for racial justice, economic and political inclusion, and civil and human rights for more than a half century, even after a neurological disorder in his later years affected his ability to move and speak. Weighing in on political events, supporting the families of black Americans killed by police, and participating in COVID-19 vaccination drives to battle hesitancy in black communities, Jackson built on a career that included running for president, international diplomacy, and influencing the lexicon of racial identity in America. Jackson clearly wasn't the lion he had been towards the end, but his presence at racial justice protests and COVID-19 advocacy events and his arrest outside the U.S. Capitol while calling on Congress to end the filibuster to protect voting rights displayed the bite left in his bark. "We've always had a place for him," said the Reverend William Barber, the second co-chair of the Poor People Campaign and one of many activists who have followed in his footsteps. Jackson urged them to live life so that it's not your alarm clock that awakes you in the morning, but a purpose. A purpose will get you up when you want to stay down. Still relevant later in life, at George Floyd's memorial service, Jackson's plaintive call, "I can't breathe," pierced the collective silence in a Minneapolis cathedral. He cried out twice more as the minutes ticked by to symbolize how long Floyd had a police officer's knee pressed on his neck. It was not only Jackson's powerful expression of his own grief over Floyd's death, which sparked global protests against racial injustice. It was a reminder that his voice still carried the singular resonance that for decades made him an international figure for civil and human rights. Jackson returned to rally demonstrators marching through downtown Minneapolis and stood with Floyd's family when a jury convicted former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin of murder in Floyd's death. "Even if we win," he told the marchers, "it's relief, not victory. They're still killing our people. Stop the violence, save the children, keep hope alive." I think the fact that he came and then came back for the judge's verdict, suffering with Parkinson's, shows the determination that Jesse Jackson had all the way to the end, Sharpton said about his longtime mentor. He once said to me, years before he was diagnosed with Parkinson, I'm not going to stop until I drop. I'm going to die on the battlefield." Early in the COVID-19 pandemic, Jackson got vaccinated and urged others to get the shot. He pointed out racial disparities in health care and partnered with the National Medical Association, which represents black physicians and patients, on a public health campaign to improve testing and treatment data and to recruit more African Americans to the medical field. "It's America's unfinished business. We're free, but not equal," Jackson told the Associated Press in a 2020 interview. "There's a reality check that has been brought by the coronavirus that exposes the weakness and the opportunity." Seeking the spotlight, redefining what was possible, Jackson had his share of critics, both within and outside the black community. Some considered him a grandstander, too eager to seek out the spotlight. Jackson was widely known for his appearance in photographs taken moments after King was assassinated on the balcony of a Memphis hotel on April 4, 1968. For 2 days afterward, Jackson wore a turtleneck he said was soaked with the venerated civil rights leader's blood, including at a King memorial service where he told the Chicago City Council, "I come here with a heavy heart because on my chest is the stain of blood from Dr. King's head." 2 decades later, Jackson made history with his runs for the White House. Until Barack Obama's election in 2008, Jackson was the most successful black candidate for the U.S. presidency, winning 13 primaries and caucuses for the Democratic nomination in 1988, 4 years after his first failed attempt. "I was able to run for the presidency twice and redefine what was possible. It raised the lid for women and other people of color," he told the AP in 2011. "Part of my job was to sow seeds of the possibilities." Jackson's cultural impact extended to the American lexicon on race and identity. In 1988, he was among a group of leaders to assert that black people wanted to be called African Americans, establishing an identity that honored the population's origins as well as their citizenship. As the founder and leader of Operation Push, which later evolved into the Rainbow Push Coalition, Jackson channeled cries for black pride and self-determination into corporate boardrooms, pressuring executives to make America a more open and equitable society. His high-profile diplomatic victories included the release of American civilians abroad during conflicts. While Jackson was known for his powerful voice, his words sometimes got him in trouble. In 1984, he apologized for calling New York City Haimy Town, a derogatory reference to the city's large Jewish population, in what he said he believed were private comments to a reporter. And in July 2008, he made headlines when a hot mic caught him complaining that Obama was talking down to black people. Still, tears streamed down his face when he joined the immense crowd in Chicago's Grant Park to celebrate Obama's 2008 election victory. "I wish for a moment that Dr. King or assassinated civil rights leader Medgar Evers could have just been there for 30 seconds to see the fruits of their labor," he told the AP years later. "I became overwhelmed. It was the joy and the journey."
Governor's race. Icy reaction. Mass Republicans blast Healey's call to defund ICE. Massachusetts Republicans are denouncing Governor Maura Healey's call to defund ICE as the governor has ramped up her criticism of the federal agency since launching her reelection campaign in January. Appearing on Sunday's edition of WCVB's On the Record program, Healey was asked about her recent executive order and legislation she filed earlier in the month to restrict ICE and its capabilities throughout Massachusetts. She was also asked if the agency should be defunded. "Yes, because I will tell you what, ICE right now has more funding than all state and local law enforcement around the country combined," Healey answered. "Right now, ICE has too much power, unbridled authority, no guardrails, and is not acting like a law enforcement agency," she said. "And that's why I say it's really not a law enforcement agency at this point." Massachusetts Republican Party is condemning Healey's latest comments about ICE, likening her calls to defund the agency to that of the farthest left wing of her party. Where was Healey's criticism when President Biden was opening the border floodgates, costing our state billions? Trump administration begins to effectively enforce our laws, and Healey now declares that entire law enforcement agency null and void. Governor is threatening to put our communities and our residents at risk, Mass GOP Chair Amy Carnevale said in a written statement. This kind of cavalier attitude is exactly why voters will agree with Republicans in 2026. Thankfully, our federal law enforcement personnel continue their work to make the United States safer again, she said. The three Republican gubernatorial candidates are also weighing in, with candidate Brian Shortsleeve saying, "No one has benefited more from the state's immigration policies than Healey," adding that she is over her head and is mismanaging the migrants' crisis. In her 2022 campaign, she tried to convince voters she was a moderate by speaking out against the defunding law enforcement. "But now that's exactly what she's supporting," Shortsleeve said in the Herald. "The best way to ensure safety, effective and efficient enforcement of our immigration laws, to avoid neighborhood raids, it's not to defund law enforcement, but to cooperate by turning over illegal criminals to local custody for deportation instead of releasing them back into our streets." Candidate Mike Keneally said Healey should partner with the federal government rather than battling with them over the migrant crisis, in which the state largely created. "Defunding law enforcement is the wrong approach to solving the multi-billion dollar migrant crisis in Massachusetts, which Maura Healey largely created by advocating for sanctuary state policies and refusing to restrict the right to shelter law to citizens. Healey should partner with the federal government to get criminals out of our Commonwealth and out of our country," Keneally said. Fellow candidate Mike Minogue is calling Healey's words dangerous and political posturing. "The governor has shown an aversion to the rule of law and public safety. Her comments and political posturing are beneath the office and dangerous for our citizens. When I'm governor, I will make sure our state and local enforcement work together with federal agencies to get violent criminals off the street," said Minogue. Healey's words come after she issued a press release demanding Republican New Hampshire Governor Kelly Ayotte to oppose the new detention and processing center planned by ICE at Merrimack Warehouse. "We should be opposing ICE's tactics, not allowing them to expand. We certainly should not be allowing ICE to build new human warehouses where they can be trusted to keep people safe and protect due process," Healey said on Friday. "I oppose this in the strongest possible terms, and I'm demanding that Governor Ayotte, who do everything in her power to block the new ICE facility in southern New Hampshire." Ayotte has since responded to Healey's demands, telling the New Hampshire Journal, "Get your own house in order, Maura," in response to Healey. New England is in this position because Governor Healey in Massachusetts created a billion-dollar illegal immigration crisis in our region. "Get your own house in order, Maura," Ayotte told the newspaper. "I will continue to advocate for the town of Merrimack and New Hampshire." Healey has sharply increased her criticism of ICE since launching her re-election campaign in January, going so far as to call individual agents rogue individuals, taking a $50,000 bounty, also claiming that Massachusetts is not a sanctuary state, despite her increased criticism and legal actions against ICE and the DHS, along with her widely criticized handling of the surge in illegal immigration during the Biden administration. "Massachusetts is not a sanctuary state. I've said this time and time again. People can buy in and continue with the absolute bull rhetoric out of the Trump administration on this. You know they have no respect for cities and states. They don't respect law enforcement because they've got this group of rogue individuals who, I guess, take in the bounty of $50,000. Healey said following a late January press conference calling the so-called ICE leadership and Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem to step down. The governor continues to state that Massachusetts is not a sanctuary state. Just a day later, Healey followed up with an announcement that she had filed an executive order prohibiting the state from entering into any new 287G agreements, while also banishing federal agents from making civil arrests in non-public parts of the state buildings. She also filed legislation that would ban ICE agents from Massachusetts courthouses, schools, hospitals, and other state-owned property, and would make it unlawful for another state to deploy its National Guard in Massachusetts without the governor's permission, among other things. Healey's recent actions and the statements against ICE, DHS, and President Trump's countrywide crackdown on illegal immigration have also drawn a reaction from the White House and acting ICE Director Todd Lyons.
From Washington, man rushes U.S. Capitol with shotgun. Suspect arrested wearing tactical gear. Motive unclear. Washington. U.S. Capitol Police in Washington, D.C. arrested an 18-year-old man Tuesday after he ran from his vehicle toward the west side of the Capitol building armed with a shotgun. Capitol Police Chief Michael Sullivan said the unidentified man parked a Mercedes SUV near the Capitol, got out, and ran several hundred yards towards the building before officers intercepted him and ordered him to the ground. Speaking at a press conference following the arrest, Sullivan said the gunman was wearing a tactical vest and gloves and had a Kevlar helmet and gas mask in the vehicle. The shotgun was loaded, and he had additional rounds on him, the chief said. Sullivan said the motive was under investigation, including whether members of Congress were the target. Congress is not in session. Sullivan said that the department has video footage, but he asked the public for any footage they might have of the incident. Who knows what would have happened if we wouldn't have had officers standing here, the chief said, adding that the department had run active shooter drills in almost the identical spot in recent months. Sullivan said the young man was not known to authorities and described him as not being from the area. The chief said the vehicle was not registered to the suspect, who has multiple addresses. There have been incidents at the Capitol in recent years, including a Capitol Police arrest in 2023, where an Atlanta man armed with a rifle was spotted in a park near the Senate. Tuesday's arrest comes 1 week before President Donald Trump's State of the Union address before Congress. Sullivan said the incident does not change the agency's plans. We take the State of the Union very, very seriously, he said. Crime in Washington is down considerably so far in 2026 from 2025, a year when there was a huge drop-off from the previous year. Trump declared an emergency in the city last August to battle crime, leading to the deployment of more than 2,000 National Guard members, as well as thousands of federal law enforcement officers and agents. The officers and agents are still throughout the city. Last week, a Washington man was killed in an encounter with U.S. Marshals service members. Authorities said the marshals were responding to a call about a person threatening to kidnap and hurt someone while holding a gun. Washington activists have asked for more transparency in that incident, which is under investigation by the city's Metropolitan Police.
Nancy Guthrie case. No DNA match on Guthrie glove. DNA from gloves found a few miles from the Arizona home of Nancy Guthrie did not match any entries in the national database, authorities said Tuesday, the 17th day of her disappearance. There were no DNA hits in CODIS, the Pima County Sheriff's Department said, referring to the National Combined DNA Index System. At this point, there have been no confirmed CODIS matches in the investigation, the department said, suggesting that other DNA samples have been put through the system. CODIS is a storehouse of DNA taken from crime suspects or people with convictions. Any hits could identify possible suspects in the Guthrie disappearance.
The 84-year-old mother of NBC Today anchor Savannah Guthrie was reported missing from her Tucson area home on February 1st after spending the previous night with family, police said. Her blood was detected on the porch. A porch camera records video of a man with a backpack who is wearing a ski mask, long pants, a jacket, and gloves. The FBI said the suspect is about 5'9" tall with a medium build. Gloves were found about 2 miles, 3.2 kilometers, from Guthrie's home. The FBI has said that the gloves appear to match those worn by the man in the video. There's an additional DNA evidence that was found at the residence, and it's also being analyzed, the sheriff's department said. In addition, the department said it's working with experts to try to locate Guthrie by detecting her heart pacemaker. Parsons Group, which is in its Blue Fly device, which weighs less than a pound, 45 kilograms, has a range of up to 218 miles, 200 meters, can detect signals from wearable electronics and medical devices. The company said that the technology has been used from the air and from the ground in Arizona. It declined further comment about the search. Savannah Guthrie posted an Instagram video Sunday in which she issued an appeal to anyone with information about what happened to her mother. It's never too late to do the right thing, she said, and we are here. We believe in the essential goodness of every human being, that it's never too late.
From business in the Seaport, another convention center hotel. The tourism and hospitality industry is very strong here, by Grace Zokovich. A new hotel will bring over 400 guest rooms to the expanding hospitality development across from the Menino Convention and Exhibition Center in the Seaport, moving ahead with Boston Zoning Commission approval. The new hotel, proposed as a joint venture between Global Hospitality Investment Group, GHIG, and a global investment management firm, would add 438 guest rooms to the existing Aloft and Element Boston Seaport hotels across from the center. The three-hotel campus includes a total of 18,000 square feet of land on D Street, owned by the Massachusetts Convention Center Authority. We look forward to growing our presence in Boston by expanding our footprint next to the Aloft and Element hotels and completing the vision of delivering a mixed-use campus with a collection of hotel brands and active retail that supports the convention center and enhances the vibrancy of D Street, said Global Hospitality Investment Group CEO Kevin Colquitt. The Boston Zoning Commission approved the new development on February 11th, following the Boston Planning Department's decision to unanimously approve the project in January. The company called the project a new urban lifestyle hotel across 160,000 square feet, sustainably designed to meet LEED Gold certification as an all-electric resilient facility. The hotel would stand at 15 stories, according to a letter of intent filed with the Boston Planning Department last March, and include parking in the existing lot at the project site. The hotel will further activate the neighborhood with a pedestrian-friendly streetscape, improved connectivity, and the creation of hundreds of local jobs, GHIG stated. Along with the Aloft and Element Boston Seaport hotels, the project would bring the total guest space across from the convention center up to 968 rooms. The development is the final phase of the campus's development, which was initiated in 2016. The new hotel would also include a new landscaped entry plaza on Anchor Street, a unique indoor-outdoor lobby bar, and a rooftop amenity space, the company said, noting it aims to solidify the area as a premier destination for business and leisure travelers. Colquitt said the extra space will help allow for the convention center's anticipated expansion goals. Colquitt said the tourism and hospitality industry is very strong here, and we're excited to bring a new lodging experience for guests, significant economic activity, and additional jobs to the city and Commonwealth. And that's all the time we have for today. Stay safe, and thank you for listening.